On behalf of Corvent, Adobe, and Cube Management, hello and welcome to today's web seminar, How to Crush Competition and Boost Sales with Strategic Marketing. My name is Leah, and I will be your event manager today. I would now like to introduce to you our speaker today, Wilson Zehr. Currently a partner in Cube Management, Wilson manages strategic marketing and channel development practice. The Portland, Oregon-based company helps organizations build winning strategies, brands, and messaging that accelerates sales. Wilson also serves as founder and CEO of Sendix, the leading provider of internet applications designed to automate channel marketing programs, www.sendix.com. A high-tech veteran of over 20 years, Wilson has crafted and managed strategic alliances with many of the largest technology and communication firms in the world, including Oracle, Sun, HP, IBM, Microsoft, Intel, Cisco, and more. In addition, Wilson has successfully led business development efforts and executed go-to market strategies for the numerous organizations, products, and brands he's been involved with, including Zermail, eFusion, and Cadre Technologies. Now, without any further delay, I'd like to turn today's program over to your presenter, Wilson Zehr. Wilson, the floor is yours.
Good morning. My name is Wilson Zehr, and the focus of the session this morning will be strategic marketing. I've spent over 20 years learning the right and the wrong way to do strategic marketing, create and manage strategic alliances, and develop winning sales channels in both the technology and the communications marketplaces. First, working for my own company, Sendix, and now as a partner with Cube Management, I've also found that many of these same principles apply broadly across a range of markets. Today, I'm going to share with you many of the same tools and techniques that we use to help our clients accelerate their sales. Thanks again for the gracious introduction, Lee. Our talk today is focused primarily on B2B sales and marketing. However, many of the same techniques apply across markets, and we'll pull in as many examples as we can as we go along to help you apply these principles to your business. Of course, as always, we encourage all your questions. We will answer all of the questions you pose if time permits, but rest assured if we don't have time to answer your specific questions on this call, I'll follow up and answer after the call is complete with a response. You should also know that we will be turning this talk into a how-to white paper on strategic marketing. Every person who participates in this call and completes the survey will receive a copy of this white paper for free once it is available. We have a lot of good stuff to share with you this morning. Thanks again for joining us on this call. So, are you getting all the sales that you want or need? Do you see deals that seem custom fit for your company snaked right out from under you? Do your customers perceive you as a slam dunk market leader? The one good thing about our business at Cube Management is that we haven't yet met a company that had all the sales they want. Strategic marketing can help you deal with all these issues and more. Please follow along and we'll show you how. What I'd like to introduce first is the strategic marketing model. You know, based on an experience over the years and a number of engagements, we've created this model to explain how all the pieces fit together. At the center of this model is the core, both the strategy of the company and the brand as well. And both have to align together to produce great results. Secondly, we introduced the five P's. Any traditional business school marketing course will introduce the four P's. We've actually added one and tuned them a little bit to better meet the needs of the markets we've addressed. And then finally, we've added just one more, and we'll save this to the end and explain how all that fits together. The next question that usually comes up is, what is marketing? Anyway, in a lot of companies, the terms marketing, business development, sales are all used synonymously to refer to the same thing, really the sales function of the organization. You know, this is understandable. The sales function is really the lifeblood of an organization. Without sales, few organizations will survive. However, in this space, we really refer to that as marketing as the little m. What we're focused on in this presentation, although we will touch on sales, is marketing with the big M, which is strategic marketing. Strategic marketing is focused on understanding the strategy of the company, the unique selling proposition for its products, and presenting both the company and its products in the best possible light. Marketing understands customers and their buying behavior in detail, anticipates objections in advance, and assures that sales close as efficiently as possible. Sales folks in organizations that do have a marketing function, it's not unusual for sales to poke fun at marketing. After all, they make the big bucks. However, most often, the most enlightened salespeople also understand that they can't be nearly as successful without the air cover provided by marketing. Somebody's got to do the positioning, produce the brochures, create the sales tools, create the training, and of course, help support those sales efforts. Both functions are required, and both functions need to work together in order for any organization to be successful. This leads us to the next topic, looking really at the core of the model, where we look at what is strategy and what is brand. Strategies, I've taken a formal definition here, and we'll dissect that a bit. Strategy is a systematic plan that identifies a critical direction and guides resource allocation for an entire organization. Now, is that theoretical enough for you? The bottom line is that strategy describes where we are going and what we're going to do to get there. As the old saying goes, if you don't know where you're going, any path will get you there. What we need to do in marketing is try and remove the guesswork, or at least remove the guesswork in our own minds regarding the company's direction. The second key element here is brand. And there seems to be some confusion in the literature about brand. You know, even as I was preparing for this presentation and looking through definitions, many, many sources talk about a brand as being a logo or a color design or some visual that you put in front of the customers. Actually, brand is much broader than this. Brand is the perception of a company or a product in the minds of customers, owners, and the community. Brand is the result of apparent actions, symbols, messages, products, and intangibles delivered over time at each touch point. In other words, brand is a combination of everything that you communicate to your customers or your prospects or your community every time you touch them. So I've got a couple of examples here that I hope will explain that in more detail. First of all, let's look at Les Schwab. How many of you are familiar with the company Les Schwab? Well, the company Les Schwab was founded in the 1950s. Owner Les Schwab bought a small tire company with, I think, less than $50,000 in sales. In his first year, he tripled it. Now, in this year, the company is still privately held, and they have about $1.5 billion in sales. That's an awful lot of car tires. Although these days they do batteries and shocks and brakes and all kinds of other things. But if you look at the company Les Schwab, I mean, it's created on some basic principles. They sell a good product that they're willing to stand behind. Every product goes out the door with a written warranty. They will repair your tires for free for the life of the tire. And in fact, in one case where I had a sidewall go out before the other three tires were ready to be replaced, they actually gave me a used tire with the amount of with the right amount of wear on it for free to get me to the right replacement. And in fact, in this company, when you bring your car in for service, the service technicians actually run, no joke, run to your car to help service it. All of these things help establish the brand that Les Schwab has created for itself and help make it a billion-dollar organization in what is a very stodgy industry by and large. The second example I have here should be familiar to everybody, IBM, Big Blue. Sure, there's a logo here that you recognize and that's, you know, recognized the globe over. But the brand around IBM can better be, you know, summarized in the series of commercials where they make the point that nobody ever got fired for buying IBM. IBM established itself as a top-tier provider, you know, a very conservative, business-oriented company. At least historically, maybe not so these days, people know that at IBM they wear blue pinstripe suits, white shirt, and tie. So all of those things, all of those messages go into the brand that is IBM, which extends well beyond the actual logo here. We could actually spend an entire session talking about brands and logos and logo design and brand philosophies, you know, what type of a branding strategy to use. But that's beyond the scope of this presentation. But I'd be happy to discuss it offline with anybody who's interested. Then the final item here is, how important is brand anyway? My answer to that is it really all depends. It depends on your marketplace and your competitors and, you know, what you have to work with. If you're thinking about a consumer product where a buyer is going to go into a retail store, as their hand reaches out to the shelf to pick a pain reliever, they're going to need to make a buying choice. At that moment in time, brand is critically important, especially if the brand next to it has some retail promotion sticking right on the shelf. However, in other kinds of market spaces, say commodity markets, it may not make little difference. Imagine a case of, you know, here we have Mount Hood. During the wintertime, you can go up and go skiing. Well, maybe if there's been a lot of snow, you have to have change to go further. If you don't have any change, you have to buy them. Because at that point in time, is the brand that they're selling at the checkpoint going to make any difference at all? I'm going to buy what's available, and so is everybody else that finds himself in that predicament. So anyway, moving on, the key element here is that it doesn't matter as much what your brand is or what your strategy is, as long as the two of them are aligned to support each other. So in order to get that alignment, it really does require an understanding of a lot of different moving parts within the organization. The good news is that the questions you ask to determine the strategy of an organization or to understand that strategy are many of the same questions you need to ask to understand or build a brand. And in fact, the questionnaire we use looks very similar for these two exercises. You can see the elements here, and I'm not going to bore you with the details of each. However, I will outline a couple that I think are extremely important. We have some intangibles: vision, mission, values, image. These are all things that are important to the organization. I'll explain where we're going and how we're going to act along the way. And these all need to be incorporated both into a strategy or into a brand. We point out here the elevator pitch. Very common in technology, but not as common in some other industries, but still critically important. The elevator pitch is a 30-second blurb that describes exactly what you do, what you sell, what your value proposition is, who your customers are. That 30-second pitch that explains what you do should be readily available to every person in the company should know that blurb. So one of the things when we go in and start interviewing people within a company, we'll ask for this elevator pitch. And we would expect to see every person in the company, from the shipping clerk to the CEO, be on the same page with regard to that message. If they aren't, it's really difficult to get alignment within an organization. We need to understand the competition. How are they competing? How they position themselves? We want to be able to create a strategy and a brand that positions us to win against the competition. We can't do that unless we understand in detail, you know, who they are and what their competitive behavior looks like. What does the roadmap look like? We look out in the future. What kinds of products and features are we already planning to release? And do those align with our brand and our strategy? Competitive distinction. You know, once we establish this position and strategy, can we maintain it? And can we maintain it through price, through product, through brand or some other method. And then finally, the one that I'll point out that may seem the most unusual here is this guiding function. What I found working with, you know, doing strategic alliances with a lot of organizations over the year, is that most organizations, especially large organizations, have one function or discipline that kind of guides the organization. Oracle Corporation is technology driven. Microsoft is marketing driven. Sequent was almost completely sales driven. So when you're trying to align strategies and brands, they need to support the mindset of the organization. If you want something to move, a strategic initiative to move within Oracle, it's a lot easier, at least historically, when I was involved with Oracle, it's a lot easier to tie it to a new technology product initiative, and then it moves. But if you came in with a new marketing program, almost no interest at all. The opposite would be true with a company like Microsoft. So moving on, we beat that one to death. I wanted to outline a tool called a SWOT analysis. SWOT standing for strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, and threats. Of course, this is, the idea here is to leverage your strengths, minimize your weaknesses, capitalize on your opportunities, and avoid the threats. This is a tool that's often presented in most business school curriculum. And unfortunately, it's also a tool that's often forgotten once people leave business school. But it's extremely useful, not only for what we're using it for here, which is strategy or brand types of analysis, but it's also valuable for addressing things like, you know, competitors, specific sales-oriented problems, other kinds of problems that you need to look at from a variety of directions to make sure you fully understand them. The key thing about this type of diagram is that you need to be brutally honest with yourself and your organization. It doesn't do any good if you're going to sugarcoat this message. So, you know, be honest about your strengths and weaknesses and where you stand. In this matrix, I put in some examples of the kinds of things we might use. Of course, these are not based on any specific company, but I wanted to explain some kind of interrelationships between the items. For example, we see at the top of strengths, we see the word nimble. The idea that that the company can move very quick. Well, that's a function, actually, of a weakness. Here at the bottom of the list, on the weakness side, we see our small size. That's a single element, small size, that can be either a weakness or a strength, depending upon how you use it. And in fact, in the case of size, if you don't use it to your advantage, it definitely does become a weakness. We also talk about strengths that can sometimes turn into opportunities. So in putting together the strengths here, for example, we've got one that says 100% customer satisfaction. Well, since I have 100% customer satisfaction, it seems natural that I might be able to leverage client referrals to get new business. So we've added that to the opportunities section. Got an item here called new government regulations. Oftentimes, there's some structural items put in place that can help a company be successful. Talked with a company recently called Poltrack that has a telephone pole inspection program. I'm not sure that I even really paid attention to telephone poles much until I talked with these folks. But it turns out that in Oregon, there's a rule that says telephone poles have to be inspected every 3 years. And of course, there are hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of telephone poles in the state of Oregon. So every one of those has to be inspected and, you know, tested, inspected, tracked, and scheduled for periodic maintenance. It turns out to be a huge job. But because of that regulation, it created an opportunity in the marketplace. And I could cite lots of other examples. At a company I work for, Vertex Corporation, we made an ADA compiler. The Department of Defense mandated ADA as a language required for all mission-critical embedded systems applications. Once again, created a huge opportunity for our company, much to the disadvantage of folks who had built infrastructure around languages like C, C++, and Fortran. And then the final item I'd like to point out here is I've got an item here called sleeping giants. Now, we need to always be tuned in to larger organizations that may not be in our marketplace now, but could be if they chose to be. There are a lot of examples of companies like Microsoft or IBM where they choose to avoid the market risk associated with early adoption of new technologies or new products. So quite often, they'll wait for a smaller company, more aggressive company, to go out, develop a market, prove the market's there, and then come in later with marketing muscle and basically throw dollars at it to take that market away. So we need to be thinking early about this idea of competitive barriers and differentiation and how we'll defend ourselves from those guys. And this is not just a technology issue. You see it in industries across the board. So the next slide here really focuses on people. And, you know, as we talk about the P's, the five P's are all important, but people is the most critical. People, in this case, stands for your customers. Because if you don't understand your customers, it's really, really difficult to build products and sell to them. So, you know, the first question is, who is your customer? If you're trying to grow your existing sales, then the best predictor of your future customers is your existing customers. So that really requires exploring your current customer database, understanding who they are, and trying to find others that look exactly like that. On the other hand, you may be expanding into new markets. In this case, this will require some primary research to understand what those target prospects look like. And when I say what they look like, what we're really talking about is demographics, title, location, size of company, industry, and another item I'll mention down here, buying behavior. So, you know, we need to understand an exact profile of who that person is that we will be building products for and marketing to. The final item I've put in this top bullet is market size. And I felt like I'd be remiss if I didn't add it, because I can think of a couple examples off the top of my head of cases where companies targeted products and markets in which the market wasn't big enough to support it. The example comes to mind of a computer company called Bine. It was a joint venture between Intel and Siemens to make a fault-tolerant computer. The combined company spent about $300 million to build that product, only to find that they had no orders, and in fact that they could, you know, once they did the analysis, they could never sell enough of these computers at that price point to actually pay for the investment and make money. So it's all well and good to have a market and a customer in mind, but we also need to make sure that at the end of the day, that customer or market is going to be able to support our efforts. So in terms of these other items here, you know, we talked about buying behavior briefly. We really need to understand what series of steps the customer is going to go through to buy our product. Are they going to ask for referrals? Are they going to look on the yellow pages? Are they going to Google us? You know, what does this behavior look like? You know, is there going to be a formal RFP? Because those are going to tell us the best way to reach the customer and influence them. You're going to see that buying behavior comes up a few times. It's a recurring theme because it is critically important. The final items here I'll throw out is that, you know, oftentimes in an organization, you're going to have to worry about multiple, people within this process, because it's not unusual to have a case where the actual end user, especially in an enterprise, with an enterprise customer, the actual end user is not the actual decision maker. There's somebody else in the organization that has the budget, has the right to make the decision. And there are a number of people that are also influencers, may have an opinion that will affect that sale in one direction or another. So in addition to understanding our end user customer, we also need to understand the other, you know, the other players that factor into that decision. The next IP that we'll explore is product. I like to, you know, talk about the distinction of between a device and a product. Bill Davido, a very successful marketer at Intel in the 80s, wrote a book called High Technology Marketing that is just as relevant today as it was when it was written. And he makes the point, especially in technology, but that there's a difference between a device and a product. Device is the thing, you know, is the technology that you build. But the product is what you offer to your customers, and it includes the device plus everything that goes around it. The, you know, the collateral, the financing, service and support, you know, the hotline, warranty, I mean, everything that's packaging, everything you bundle together to give the customer creates a product. So when we're in the process of defining this, we need to, you know, make sure that we're not focused, we don't get stuck solely focused on the device. We're expanding our view and really looking at the product for the customer. In terms of primary elements, you know, the first item on the list is always benefits. It's really, really easy to get stuck, you know, to start out and wanting to dive in and define features. What is this thing going to do? However, it's almost always a better idea to start out with the benefits. What is the problem you are trying to solve? Where's the pain? Then from there, coming up with distinctive features that are going to help you address that pain for your clients. Competitive differentiation, you know, how are you different from your competitors? How are you solving the problem in a way or removing that pain in a way that's different from what your competitors are doing, and why is your way better? That's important to understand. We create product requirements, and then we also have to look is, you know, at the market window and the price point. The market window is important because, you know, while you're building or packaging or preparing your product or service for market, the market's not standing still. So what you're planning, if you look out at the market today, what you see today is most likely different than what you'll see, you know, 6 months from today, you know, depending on how fast-moving your market is. So we need to pick a window and try and forecast what will be required at the time when we can release this product. And then price point, of course, requires some design trade-offs. I mean, imagine, to take a low-tech example, imagine a lunch wagon in an industrial area of any major U.S. city. Probably, if you're designing a menu, your price point based on your customer is probably somewhere in the $5 range. So if you were designing a list of menu items for this $5 menu, you wouldn't use caviar or truffles, no matter how good they tasted. So price point does become a factor in this process. So I think I've gone one too far here, you guys. So here's backing up. We talk about product release bundles. This is this particular slide is a little more tech focused, but it can apply across the board as you design your products and services. The whole idea is to figure out what the, you know, you, now that you understand the benefits, the problems you're trying to solve, looking out and trying to find, you know, the universe of features that could really help address that problem. You know, those ideas come from customers, they come from internal brainstorms, they come from trade shows, industry experts, focus groups, any source that you can imagine, you should try and pull those together. You know, as a domain expert, you can weed out the ones that don't make sense at all, ending up with a list. And then as you work through that list, you need to really look at the ROI for each feature. ROI meaning how many more sales does it drive, and what does it cost in terms of resources and time, and then prioritize each of these features based on those criteria. You know, once again, establish a target market window and understand the resources available. And then when we talk about maximizing the return on resources, we're really talking about going through this list again and reprioritizing based on the market window. So, for example, we may find one feature that has a high return, but it takes a lot of resources to deliver. But we may have three little features that on their own have a small return, but can be delivered more quickly. And when we combine those three, we end up with an overall benefit that's greater that will still help us meet our market window. So we may decide to move those items up on the list and move something bigger down so we can get to market faster with something that adds more value. Then, of course, we draw the cut line that allows us to hit our market resources with the maximum upside, or to hit our market window with the maximum upside. The next page here is really looking at enlightened product development. And I felt that I would be remiss if I didn't, you know, touch on some of these items that are the product of experience over time. Product development, I mean, really need to establish the core, enhance systematically with smaller kind of, you know, planned releases rather than try and do everything at once. Publish realistic dates that allow you to set expectations and deliver on time. In marketing, this becomes especially important because if we're planning PR and advertising and training and a lot of other activities, we need to, you know, make sure that everything comes together when it's supposed to. Above all, avoid the big bang. Avoid the, you know, 6 to 12 month product release cycle where you have, you know, 10,000 features. In that case, what, you know, it may seem like a good idea, but what really happens is you really, you know, multiply the potential for error, and, you know, and really increase the risk that the market is moved by the time you get there. If the issues do arise, and they will arise, eliminate them quickly. Customers appreciate fast resolution, and, you know, just like in the example of Les Schwab, where people come running to your car. You know, if you can address issues quickly and knock them out, your customers will forgive and appreciate the, forgive the error and appreciate the effort. And then listen to your customers. I mean, that seems so obvious, but it's funny how often that gets ignored. Your customers can't always predict which technology is going to be best for them down the road because often, or, you know, product, because they may not have a window into all that's available, but they do know where their pain is. And they do know whether you're giving them what you're giving, whether what you're giving them is helping or not. So we need to learn based on that experience. Moving on to pricing, you know, there's always, in most organizations, there's a lot of discussion on this topic. People go back and forth on what's the right price point, what's the right model. You know, I have to say, though, in my experience, this is probably the easiest of the P's to solve. The reason for this is there really is, you know, there's one element that you can't ignore, which is the cost of goods, right? Unless we're doing a strategy like Gillette, where you sell the razor to, or you give away the razor to sell the blades, we really can't, you know, don't want to be selling products below cost because we're not going to make it up in volume, probably. But disregarding that, there's really only two factors that determine pricing. One, what's the value to the customer? But when they purchase your product and service, what are you going to save them in time? What are you going to, you know, are you going to increase revenues? Are you going to increase productivity? What does that look like? Because that's going to justify what they are willing to pay for your product. Second, what are the competing solutions and what price point are they at? If a customer, if a competitor has a product that solves the problem equally as well as yours, is equally as complete as yours and has a lower price point, all other things being equal, you're at a tremendous disadvantage. So those two items can almost always lead us in the right direction, which introduces this model on page 14, which I call the natural selection model. the whole idea here, and I'll use the example of Sequent, is that there's a difference between the value or the completeness of a solution versus the price point. In Sequent's case, we sold high-end Oracle database servers. And at that time, a 100-gigabyte database was massive. And if we looked at that market space, Sequent had probably 138 databases of that size on Oracle. HP had 7, Sun had 1. We totally dominated the market space. So what happened? Well, what you'll see is that, you know, based on Sequent's volume of computers and the expense associated with R&D, their cost of goods was relatively high relative to the competitors. And the reason for that is because these higher volume competitors coming up market can spread their R&D costs over a larger base. And at any point in time, if they can reach the same level of completeness or provide the same level of value with their solution at a lower price, it becomes really difficult. So that was the demise, you know, or ultimate acquisition of Sequent by IBM, is when Sun and HP both reached that point. This model here is general as well. You could use it to apply to high-end SUVs, manufacturing equipment, or any other products if you need to understand the value-based market, the value-based market dynamics in any space. Moving along, there are several other things to consider with pricing. Some of these are obvious. I won't spend a lot of time on it, but one element is price elasticity that I want to talk a little bit more about. Unless you've been to B school, you may not have been exposed to this concept. But the idea is that oftentimes you can increase revenue just by, you know, increasing price, assuming that you have a good value proposition and a strong product. However, there is a point at which if you increase the price any farther, the volume of units sold will fall off to a level where revenues don't actually rise, they fall. And so if you're tuning, you know, competition aside, if you're tuning a price to find the maximum point, you'd like to find that point at which if you raise your price any further, revenues will actually fall rather than grow. And you can do that by testing, adjusting price, and looking at the results. The whole idea of annuity pricing, you know, companies like Tektronix have taken the Gillette model to a new level. Tektronix actually had a program a couple of years ago. Not sure if it's still running today, but at one time you could actually get a free color printer if you committed to a certain volume of usage every month. And the reason for that is because the margins in the ink, and they know if you're producing a certain volume, they're going to make a certain amount of money on the ink. So it becomes very easy to justify giving you the printer. And, of course, once you have their printer, you're going to have to buy their ink. So that makes sense. And the final item here is promos. And the reason I've highlighted this is because oftentimes if you lower prices, it's harder to raise them again. So if you're trying to create, you know, meet a near-term sales objective, or if you're trying to do something like move B leads to A's, which we'll discuss in a further slide, promos can be a very useful tool to create an impending event where somebody's, you know, encouraged to buy sooner rather than later. The next item we'll talk about here is place, which is really the sales channel. The one key thing for this slide is that, you know, sales is a process, not an event. I remember, after closing a big deal with Bell Canada some years ago, talking with a friend and saying, man, you know, I just closed this big deal, but I'm worried about making my number, you know, next quarter. How do you deal with that? He said, well, I'm not worried at all because I treat sales as a process. I'm just filling the funnel, and I'm helping each of those customers move to the next stage in the funnel. As long as I fill it at the right rate and continue to move people through, the sales will happen exactly when they need to. And I think that's a really healthy way to approach it. Here you'll see the division between marketing and sales. Marketing's job is really to feed the funnel and then to provide the materials and training, tools and training required to move a prospect through that funnel. Of course, the marketing and sales may share that task of lead qualification, But marketing's job is to make sure that that funnel is filled with qualified leads, and the tools are there to close the deal. In terms of place, you know, we often have to address this idea of channel selection. What's this, you know, what is the right channel for our product? Price point, of course, lower priced products or low margin products require a less expensive channel. You wouldn't send a direct salesperson, you know, out to sell a product, a very low priced product or a very low margin product. But it might very well lend itself to direct response marketing. The next two, completeness of solution and complexity, you know, we may actually be called upon in the sales channel to help complete the solution. You'll see a lot of technology companies might, you know, have a sales engineer or an overlay sales force based on a specific domain or piece of knowledge. And that's all designed to help ease the sale of a complex product or product that's more of a device than a complete product. And in terms of channel choices, there are a lot of different alternatives here. The one thing we've seen more of in recent years is a combination of channels where we combine online and inside and direct sales. Or maybe we use telesales as a front end to direct sales to increase the momentum. So, you know, really finding the optimal mix really boils down to understanding the customer, buying behavior, price point, and complexity of the product, and then finding the right mix between these elements. And then finally, we come to the issue of promotion. And I'm going to speed up a little bit here because I've got a couple of items to cover, and I can see we're running a little short on time. But in terms of promotion, once again, you'll see this theme again, understanding buyer behavior. It's you know, incredibly important. Defining the sales process and figuring out what materials are required to advance the sale at each touch point. And really, we talked about qualified leads. It's amazing to me how many folks still look at all leads as being created equal. Historically, you know, in a well-managed marketing program, we tend to divide leads in, you know, based on qualification. Here I've talked about A, B, and C leads, where A leads are those with, you know, are those with interest, budget, and that will act in some relatively short time frame. B leads just have interest and budget. C leads have only interest. And then there's everything else, which is just noise. 90% of the focus of sales should be working on these A leads. And the focus of marketing should be finding more A leads and trying to move Bs into As. And then finally, critical element is just to sell benefits, not teach features. We've already talked briefly about that. Selecting the optimal mix. Here, you know, we talk about, you know, three big clumps. I've put these into advertising, public relations, and viral. In advertising, there are a ton of different ways to advertise your product, and it really depends where your clients live, what their buying behavior is that allowed you to touch them in the right place. Rest assured, there are as many ways to spend your money on advertising as you could ever imagine. You spend as much as you want, so you need to, you know, be diligent. Public relations is really letting other people tell our story for us through press releases, through articles, through, you know, editorials, things, trade shows. Interviews at trade shows, I guess, that kind of thing. And final, viral. The whole category of viral really, you know, got some additional credibility in the .com era. It was originally coined by Tim Draper because they found that with the product Hotmail, if they put a little line at the end of each email that said, get your free Hotmail account, people would click on it and the product would expand virally. And, you know, since that time, people have found that they can create the same effect by using clips or jokes or other kinds of things that people would want to share with their friends and family. Mark Beep, John Morrell, and most recently TV commercials all end up in emails distributed around that can give you a viral marketing reach. great tool to, you know, to leverage when it's available. But I want to take a minute to talk about the internet, because this seems to be the rage as people talk about marketing today. You know, the online basics are the internet's not the same thing to all people. First, it can be used as a communication substrate, like email or instant messaging. It can be used as an information portal, for example, with Google. And quite often, this is the way, especially in business-to-business, people use it. They'll use a tool like Google to go out and research their purchase and then actually make the purchase directly with the vendor, you know, over the phone or in person. And then finally, they use it as a sales channel, like Amazon does. I remember listening to a talk with Jeff Bezos where he said, basically, the internet was going to replace all bricks and mortar. And at the time, I remember thinking to myself, well, that just ignores the whole history of commerce. You know, in the old days, people got the Sears Roebuck catalog. They ordered stuff and waited for it to come in the mail. But as soon as they could go to a Walmart down the street, that Sears Roebuck catalog went right in the trash. And I think that's the same phenomenon we have here. You know, the total size of the internet, you know, marketplace, it looks like a fancy catalog sale. And, you know, although we can get more people participating in the market, and it's a lot fancier catalog, still, you know, that doesn't spell the end of bricks and mortar. And it can't, you know, so we can't isolate our marketing efforts to look only in that space as well. In terms of actual tools, I mean, things to consider in online marketing is the reach. You know, most prospects don't live online. And in fact, there's new stats out that's saying up to 17% of the population are active technology avoiders. So they won't go online no matter what you do. And if those people are part of your mix, then, you know, part of your customer mix, then you need to figure out how to address it. Active versus passive, address the fact that most internet advertising is passive. People have to come to you. You can't come to it, unlike direct mail or telesales, something along those lines. And you need to think about whether your real objective is to build rapport, which a tool like, you know, email newsletters are very good, generate leads, which are a lot more well-suited to SEO or pay-per-click, or actually close sales, which is something e-commerce sites need to be concerned with. Lots of tools in this space. You know, marketing on the web is much more than SEO and pay-per-click. You need to explore the right mix that makes sense. And then finally, we talk about the final P, which is positioning, which is a combination of all of these elements. Right? So being able to tune, you know, being able to tune the various other P's to create a defensible competitive position that is going to give you breakthrough sales momentum. So finally, we need to, you know, if we're looking at applying all these principles, we really need to align the strategy with the brand, optimize the 5 P's to create winning positioning, and execute flawlessly. This all reminds me of this recent Snapple commercial talking about green tea. And the guy was saying, what is green tea anyway? And then they show him in a field, you know, in China, on a hilltop in China somewhere, with this old master saying, you know, we find the tender baby tea leaves and we pluck them. And he says, is that it? And he says, that's it. Marketing is much the same way. A lot of common sense. You can just, you know, work through this equation, fine-tune it, and you're golden. That's the end of the prepared materials I have today. We'd be happy to take any questions you have.
Wilson, thank you so much. That was some great information. So if you'd like a copy of today's slides, please email us at events@corventollc.com. At this time, Wilson, we're going to go ahead and open it up for Q&A.
Okay.
And it looks like we've got a few questions coming in.
You know, the first question I'm seeing here is, how important is it to religiously following brand guidelines? Can we be more, and I guess the rest is cut off here in mind.
And it's actually, can we be more creative than sticking to just the brand guidelines?
Yeah.
That's the rest of the question.
Okay. My answer to that is that, you know, the real power of brand is communicating or sending a consistent message over time. So, in fact, if you do, you should have a brand guideline, and if you do have one, you're way ahead of the game because most people don't. But I do think it is important to have a consistent message, image, presence at every touch point with the client. So, you know, my advice would be, rather than just deviating from the brand guideline, would be if there's something that you feel is missing in the brand that's not allowing you to do your job, then you need to work with others in the organization to fix the brand and to fix the guidelines, rather than just ignoring them. Let's see. Any ideas regarding pricing for web-hosted products? You know, that's really going to depend on, once again, competition and value proposition for the customer. So it requires understanding the customer, what the specific product is, and what their alternative solutions are. You know, a lot of folks today on the hosted model are going for, pay-as-you-go. I certainly think that, you know, that's really the future of software moving forward. People are going to pay for things as they receive them. So I certainly think those kind of models make sense at this juncture. However, if we want to talk about specific prices, we have to get a lot more specific about solutions and competitors. Let's see. You get a copy of the presentation? Sure, no problem.
Again, if you'd like a copy of the presentation, go ahead and email us at events@corventllc.com. The email address is actually in the welcome note section to the left of the presentation today on your screen.
Yeah, I've got a question here that says, how do you test pricing when you have a small number of customers in a new product segment? And I think that, you know, that can be an issue, but I also think oftentimes it's not just a matter of testing pricing, it's a matter of selling pricing. So you're going to have to, you know, understand the value proposition of your product or offer for that specific customer, and then come up with the selling proposition that supports the pricing that you determine. Now, of course, that's all going to be, you know, going to be affected by what your competitive or competing solutions are being offered for. So, I mean, there's a theory of thought that maybe you test and find the right price point, and I think that's certainly valid. But in cases like this where you've got a limited area to sample in anyway, I think it's a lot better to understand value, competitors, and find a way to justify the price that you think makes sense. And then, of course, if you need to discount and negotiate, then you can go from there.
Great. Wilson, looks like we have time for one more question. And while you take that question, I'm going to go ahead and open the survey again, just in case those of you who weren't able to access it. We will try it again and see if you can access it. Otherwise, just go ahead and close out of it. So we're ready for the last question, Wilson.
Okay. The one I have here is, how do you feel the future of email campaigns will be? You know, I really, the last company I started was called Zairmail, and we automated direct mail campaigns for real direct mail, letters, postcards, self-mailers, that kind of thing. And this question came up a lot, you know, isn't that retro? How does email fit? Well, it turns out that, first of all, aside from the fact that, you know, that marketing to through email, you know, more than once is against the law, there are a lot of other things that, you know, that don't work to its benefit. One is, you know, targeting. So with direct mail, if I wanted to, or a tool like that, if I want to reach, married Dennis in New Jersey with a house more than $500,000, I can find that list. If I want to do it on the internet, I can't, you know, through email. Plus, email really is a slice of a slice if you start looking at the demographics, who you can actually reach, whereas a tool like direct mail could reach every consumer and business in America. With that said, direct mail does have some expense associated with it, you know, and today the greatest of those expenses is around postage. So we find that email is a very good tool, not necessarily for prospecting, But if we can get a customer's permission and do something like a newsletter email blast, it's a very good tool for building rapport. And once you have that rapport, if you can include offers and other value add within that communication, it becomes a very powerful tool, much more so than than an offline medium like a direct mail. At least when you factor in the cost, the relative cost. This is one of those topics that that is a special interest area for me, and we could probably spend hours talking about it. But that's the short answer.
Great, thank you so much, and we appreciate all the questions that came in today. Again, Wilson's email is on the screen, so if you'd like to shoot him an email, feel free to do so. At this time, thank you all so much for your participation today, Wilson. Thank you for that great information. Please remember your registration for today's event makes you eligible to win a free 30-gig Apple iPod video. And we'll be holding the drawing July 13th, and we'll contact the winner by the registration information they provided. And if you want to increase your chances of winning the Apple iPod, please visit www.corventllc.com to register and attend our next event, What Every Marketer Should Know About Effective Web Design. Thank you all so much, and you may now disconnect from the audio and breeze portion of today's event, and have a great day.
Thanks, everyone.